before I think people will give you power, they don't even ask, do they like you? They ask whether you like them. And I think a lot of the country feels we don't like them. I believe that. I know that. I've seen the focus groups. I've seen the survey data. I've talked to the people who work on this.
Why though?
And that's going to require.
Why though?
Changing that is going to require.
Because if they think that you don't like them, is it because of what you say? Or is it because of what the other side says you say? Like, if you were to ask the average conservative right now, what was the left's response to Charlie Kirk's shooting? The right is going to tell you what the right-leaning media has shown them of the left.
There is an assassination cult. We've seen the polling on it. 55% of liberals think it's okay to politically assassinate people.
Nobody's going to show you Obama's statements, Biden's statements, Kamala's statements.
He did not hate his opponents. He wanted the best for them.
You think that Trump tries to stay in office for a third term? I'm thinking no, but the only reason why I'm thinking no is because the age and health thing will be extremely detrimental. I don't know if he's going to make it through his current term, but like if he's healthy enough to, I think he absolutely will.
That's where I disagreed with Charlie.
What is it? It's frightening to see the president of the United States talk this way about his political foes.
I hate my opponent, and I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry.
The other, I think, is it's an opportunity. I don't think that is a strong politics. And for me, one of the central questions animating the show this year, that has been animating it since the election, is how did we get here? How did we let these people get back into power? What went wrong in our approach to politics that we ended up here? This has been a conversation.
Oh God, I'm either gonna love this or it's gonna trigger the fuck out of me.
And engaged in since Charlie Kirk's murder. And I wanted to have it with somebody who has maybe not liked who I've been approaching it. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a writer I admire, somebody I have a genuine friendship with. In the days after Kirk's murder, he published a piece in Vanity Fair, pretty harshly critical of what I had written. He compared what I was doing there to the whitewashing of the Southern cause after the Civil War. I think it'd be the height of hypocrisy for me to say we need to reach across divides and disagreement and then not talk across my own. So I want to talk to Ta-Nehisi about the piece, about the aftermath of Kirk's murder, but also about a disagreement, or question at least, that I think is about more than Kirk. I think there's something very unsettled in the sort of broad coalition of the left around the work of politics, around who we talk to and when and how. When is that work moral?
Oh, this f***ing loser did do this. Ed Martin in front. Keep in mind that these guys just passed an executive order. Donald Trump just signed an executive order to criminalize, like, left-leaning extremists, whatever that means, Antifa members, whatever that means, from doxing people, whatever that means, right? Literally, I don't know what any of these things are going to be defined as in terms of how they're going to enforce anything, okay? And then here's Ed Martin, who was, so what the f*** was this guy's job? Was he a prosecutor or an attorney? I don't know what the, but he accused the Letitia Jones of some wrongdoing, I guess, relating to mortgages or whatever. I haven't even followed the Letitia James. I haven't followed this stuff. Was any of this real, or did any of this pan out to anything, or has this been all like tossed like the Federal Reserve lady? He goes to her f***ing house to take a picture? Why? It's so weird. And this isn't for like a conviction. This isn't even for an indictment. It's just for an accusation.
When is it necessary? When is it a betrayal? As always, my email is ezraKleinshow@nytimes.com. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I don't know what number time this is.
I think you're one of the, if you go back to the box space, I think you're one of the, you're on the leaderboard for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, it's good to see you, man.
Good to be here, Ezra. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's jump into the disagreement. You wrote a column responding to my column on Charlie Kirk.
It's so uncomfortable.
It's okay. What was your disagreement with what I wrote after Kirk was assassinated?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to thank you for having me. You know, I know that I've had to read things about myself that, you know, criticize my work. It's never easy. And people often have a very, very different response than the one you had, which is to invite me here and talk it out. So I appreciate that. I want to say that up front. I felt that when I initially read the column, I guess we should be fully trans.
Democrats, calling your political opponents Nazis has consequences. Study, left-wing terrorism climbs to a 30-year high. What are the other things? The White House deputy press secretary looked at this graph and thought, those gray bars are totally fine. Everyone will understand that only the yellow ones are a problem. Okay, based.
Transparent here and say there was a discussion between us privately before there was a, you know, a public thing.
Yeah, we text.
Yeah, we did. We do text regularly and we did text about this. So I felt like having not done the research that I eventually did for the college, there was something off about what I knew about this guy and the presentation of him as, and I don't want to misquote you here, but as basically a paragon of politics and how politics should be done. I think I had the same reaction that most ordinary people would have, which is absolute horror. At the idea that this guy was somewhere speaking and
you have to see the chart from the original study. Left-wing versus right-wing terrorist attacks and plots in the United States. Oh, no. Not good.
And was killed. But I always think it's like important to differentiate how people die versus how they live. And then after doing the research, I gotta be honest with you. That's when it got really, really difficult. When I went past my initial impressions and started like going through all of the clips of the things he said, the way he talked about people, the way he, you know, described groups in ways that honestly, even as I was writing it, I was uncomfortable saying. And so the idea that this guy should be in any way celebrated for how he conducted politics, the fact that he just slurred across the board, you know, all sorts of groups of people, and then ran an organization wherein, you know, which appeared to me just a haven of hatred, you know? I would not want that to be a model for my politics. And I know, you know, as we talked between us that, you know, you are not attempting to make a statement for the entirety of it. But I guess I feel like at a certain point, somebody's legacy or somebody does something that is so large that it's tough to think about their legacy and take that out of it. And that's how I felt about it.
So I think I want to get at the right level of disagreement here. So I think one thing for me is that, I don't know, for me, the immediate hours after somebody is murdered in public, when you see that sort of grief and horror pouring out of the people who loved him and many people loved him, my instinct then is to just sit with them in their grief, mm-hmm. right? To say, I can for this moment find some way to grieve with you, to see your friend the way, or in some version of the way you saw him, right? That's not my view of, you know, the person's whole legacy, but going to people when they're grieving like that and saying, listen, I want to tell you really what I thought of your friend. Mm-hmm. Just feels, it feels like not what you do in a kind of a community.
Mm-hmm. One thing that Ezra needs to understand, I don't know if these guys, because they all talk to each other and they're all part of like this network of people, is, and I notice this more, I'm expanding this from my take of like cooperation or prisoner's dilemma or whatever, is people are truly not used to interacting with people that don't have your best interests at heart or don't have a mutual understanding of how you should both operate. This idea of extending goodwill to someone in a time of tragedy, all of these things that we do, all of these very normal and very ordinary human behaviors that we do, assume or presume some amount of humanity on the other side. None of these things work when the other side does not reciprocate. And not only do they not work, all of these systems are hijacked and taken advantage of by the other side. And you can't allow that to happen. On an interpersonal level, sure, you can do it because it's your life, it's whatever. But not when you're going to be a political voice for people. You have to be strong. You have to push back against your emotional loading of things if the other side is willing to take advantage of it. I'm not going to find it. I don't think this is on my separate. I think it was a tweet. Somebody tweeted out something about like, this was a guy who went on media literally 1 hour after Charlie Kirk's death and was speaking about things. I'm not gonna be able to find it. But like these people took his death and they turned it into like a political event, like immediately, literally before they even knew who the shooter was, right? They already had an ideology ascribed to him. They already blamed him for a certain thing. They had the political enemies lined up. Like they had the whole movie basically already shot, no pun intended, like hours after the whole event happened. And then they allowed it all to unfold however it would, you know, going forward on television. That was it. The whole narrative was written like hours after this dude died.
I can see people come down on both sides of that.
I actually think that
actually you do in a kind of a community.
Mm-hmm.
I can see people come down on both sides of that.
I actually think that actually is a great impulse, that after somebody's been killed, and not just killed, but because we live in the media.
Oh, is this?
Great.
1 hour after Charlie Kirk was pronounced dead, Brillin Hollihan appeared on Fox News, beaming ear to ear. Oh, these guys are running with the conspiracy that it was planned or whatever, I guess, and he's happy for his new leadership position.
It's also an incredible story that you share with us really quickly, Brillin, about fourth grade, a podcast. That's incredible. And Charlie Kirk appears on your podcast. Tell me about the role he played for you as a mentor.
Yeah, again, it's somebody that didn't have to do that. He was on Fox News every other hour that year. He didn't have to make time for me as an 11-year-old with this upcoming podcast in the fourth grade to come on and join me, but he did. And not only was it a one-time thing, I've interviewed hundreds of people that I've never talked to again. He stayed a mentor, and he texted me up until this week when I was on another Fox show congratulating me. Like, he didn't have to do that. He could have given me his competition. He could have said, oh, I'm not going to give this kid time, but he did. And what I think the larger thing here is the left loves to preach tolerance. They love to preach.
I was almost going to give him credit. I was thinking of like, well, I don't like that he's making it political about podcasts and shit, but I mean, like, if that's what he's doing, that's fine. But then he immediately goes into the talking points.
I'm not going to give this kid time, but he did. And what I think the larger theme here is the left loves to preach tolerance. They love to preach tolerance. And in situations like this, that's the last thing we're seeing. The media coverage on the other side of the aisle is not like this. I was just scrolling through channels. And obviously the person that took this life, this is heartbreaking, Will. And I really hope, if anything, that people get off the sidelines. This weekend, I'm going to a youth rally in South Carolina. And you better believe that I've already had my team shoot me text saying, Brown, you really need to caution this. You really need to think about not standing in the middle. You better believe that I've already had my team shoot me text saying, Brown, I'm going to a youth rally in South Carolina. And you better believe that I've already had my team shoot me text saying, Brown, you really need to caution this. You really need to think about not standing in the middle of a park and speak to the next generation. But I am more energized than ever to carry on this torch, to carry on this legacy, because that's what Charlie would have wanted. He would have wanted us to continue to fight the good fight just like he did.
No doubt, Ryland. No doubt. Thank you so much.
Like, that's crazy.
Media environment that we live in, that it's seen, and that it will live forever, and that person's family, you know what I mean?
That is being looped in front of all
Jesus
of us,
Christ.
Which I think has a lot to do with how this was taken.
No, it's terrible. It's terrible. And to have to go, like, to have young kids who have to grow up knowing that that is a thing that exists in the world. You know what I mean?
And I'll go one step further on this. One thing I wrote about in the piece that I do worry about is I worry we're already in a cycle of political violence, of mimetic violence.
Yeah?
I think about Pelosi, I think about Shapiro, I think about the near assassination on Trump. I think about when after that happened, I thought about me, I thought about you, I thought about all kinds of people I know, right? So I do think there's just something about when violence takes hold that you, like, that there's something about it that it begins to breach all lines.
So I guess
that's part of my reaction too.
You know, I think all of that is understandable, but I guess, was silence not an option?
Yeah, silence to me was not grieving with people. I felt it was important as someone who is liberal, as someone who is a voice, that there are moments like that. Like, I really do feel, and it's funny because you said something like this in your piece, but it was a little bit more offhanded, that political violence like that is an attack on us all.
Right.
And that in that moment, it creates, for me, even if it's very temporary, that it's important in a moment like that to sort of, come together, to try to see other people in their grief, to try to cool things down just a little bit. I guess, given everything you read that Charlie Kirk said, and we probably don't have very different views on the value of the things he said, why do you think he was winning?
I mean, that's not really hard for me to understand. I mean, if I could just back up for a second, I want to say two things. You know, I published a book 10 years ago, Between the World and Me. And one of the constant reactions to that was that it was overly pessimistic about this country. It was overly pessimistic about the future. Why are you so dark, Ta-Nehisi? Why can't you give us any sense of hope? And the reason I would always say is because any sort of sober examination of the history of this country says that those of us who believe in equality, those of us who believe in respecting the humanity of our neighbors and of, you know, everyone, that we're up against some really, really powerful forces of history and powerful, powerful narratives. And the implication of that is, however good we felt in 2013, 14, 15, 2008, there will be backlash. You know, people, you know, those of us who were crying in 2008 watching Obama, you know what I mean, give that speech, you know, those of us who were so moved by watching him and Michelle and step outside the car and felt so much fear for him, and then when nothing happened, felt so great about that. Those of us who believe that seeing a Black family in the White House mirroring what, you know, some of us felt the best of us was the best that we had to offer, there are other people watching that too. You know what I mean? And I
would have said 2 months ago, this is so cringe. I don't think it's that deep, mate. Listening to Ben Shapiro and Megyn Kelly still like being so ass-pained about Obama, I'm like, what the f-? I cannot believe. I just can't believe it. I can't process it. I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it. I hope that I don't have like one of the worst moments, I think, when you, if you're a guy, this is why you should always just hate the other gender, okay? No empathy, okay? But one of the weirdest, worst moments is when you kind of like get a little bit more aware of kind of the weird, like creepy shit that women deal with on a daily basis. You realize that it's like pervasive. It's in all sorts of different areas. It's in the weird ways that guys will touch you when you're standing in front of a, you know, sign and they're passing you on the streets, and the weird ways that people treat. It's just like there's like a lot of weird shit. When you see it, it's like it's very annoying to see everywhere. I'm wondering if like the racial shit or whatever, even if it's not like outward in the way that people act or whatever, is something that's like lurking so much more than, I don't know, man. I just, hearing Megyn Kelly and Shapiro talk about Obama is such a, is, I was so unhinged. And then going back to the DEI stuff, hearing people just hearing, not to be too woke here, hearing white people, I would just never get over this. Hearing white people say that Kamala Harris was unqualified to be president is just one of the most mind-blowing things in my entire life. I just can't believe that somebody would say that. You can make a lot of criticisms of her, but especially compared to Trump and the actual like retard circus that this guy is constantly surrounding himself with, unqualified is the last word that can come out of your mouth after you spilled the last 7 loads of Trump that you're saving in your chipmunk cheeks. Like, that's just an unhinged, it's an unbelievable perspective to have on things. They're just so milquetoast. Like, I can understand, you know, for Destiny, like, people are like, oh, that fucking Destiny guy, I heard him say that thing, and it triggered the fuck out of me. But listening to Ben talking to Ezra Klein, and Ben Shapiro talking about how, when Obama said that Trayvon looked like him, and it's like, that is still with you? Why the fuck do you care?
You know, it turns out that Black people in America, they're inherently victimized by a system, by a white supremacist system that puts Black people underfoot. And my son, think the left perceives the Obamacare moment as the moment that the right sort of radicalized. And I don't think that that's actually right. I think the Bitter Clinger's comments were a big one. That was in the 2008 election. I think the Henry Louis Gates statements.
Recently, Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. was arrested at his home in Cambridge. What does that incident say to you? And what does it say about race relations in America?
In which he suggested that the officer had acted stupidly and then sort of linked that with racial discrimination in the past.
I think it's fair to say, number one, any of us would be pretty angry. Number two, that
any of us,
the Cambridge police, acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home. And number three, what I think we know separate and apart from this incident is that there is a long history in this country of African Americans and Latinos being stopped by law enforcement disproportionately.
These are like the most inoffensive milquetoast statements you can make in your life. Just as a reminder, this was like a Harvard professor that got arrested for breaking into his own home because somebody called the cops on him because they're like, some guy's trying to break into his house. Apparently his lock didn't work. And the cops showed up and he actually arrested him there.
That's just a fact.
The Trayvon Martin situation was quite polar.
And then Obama's response to this was he invited both the cop and the professor to the White House and they had like a drink and they all chilled and they chatted. And that was like Obama's like the culmination of that whole event. Like to compare this and say this was a radicalizing moment for white America, bro, are you serious?
Being stopped by law enforcement disproportionately. That's just a fact.
The Trayvon Martin situation was quite polarizing for sure.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
The Ferguson riots, those I think would be sort of the biggest examples of Barack Obama kind of setting off the right, so to speak.
It's interesting you choose those. I mean, those are mostly first rhetorical examples. It's like, take the Bitter Clinger's comment, because I actually think about this one a lot, mm-hmm. where he gets caught on the...
It's just like so crazy that they still hold on to the... I don't know. That's like a thing that makes me... Like, if I had a friend tell me that, I would just assume the friend is probably racist. That would just be my go-to. Like, that would be like an obvious, like, okay, no more edgy jokes around you, my friend. That's just crazy to me.
Believe that seeing a black family in the White House mirroring what, you know, some of us felt the best of us was the best that we had to offer. There are other people watching that too. You know what I mean? And I don't take any joy in saying this, but we sometimes soothe ourselves by pointing out that love, acceptance, warmth, that these are powerful forces. I believe they are. I also believe hate is a powerful force. I believe it's a powerful, powerful, unifying force. And I think...
I wish that more people would understand this. Because I say this a lot when people are like, oh, why the edgy jokes and all this? It's like, well, the other side makes them. You have to understand that the other side is not engaged in self-destruction. There is a strategy to having an enemy and to hating the enemy and to dehumanizing the enemy. There's a reason why so many like entities throughout all of human history have done this. And it is a powerful unifying thing. Like you can't just view like the morally good actions as being good in every single scenario and the morally bad actions as being bad in every single scenario. That only works in fiction. People have to remember that in stories or in video games, when you choose the good option, or in the Bible, when there's a good option, that's because the author wants to convey a positive moral message to the reader or to the consumer of the art. And so the end message is always going to be that doing the right thing always pays off. But these obvious drawbacks to being bad aren't always obvious and not always realized immediately, or sometimes not realized at all. It really depends on the circumstances.
Charlie Kirk was a hate monger. You know, I really need to say this over and over again. I have a politic that rejects violence, that rejects political violence. I take no joy in the killing of anyone, no matter what they said. But if you ask me what the truth of his life was, you know, and the truth of his public life, I would have to tell you it's hate. I would tell you, I'd have to tell you it is the usage of hate and a harnessing of hate towards political ends.
Then let me flip that question actually a bit.
Mm.
Why are we losing?
We're losing because there are always moments when we lose.
See, that feels very fatalistic to me.
It doesn't feel fatalistic to me. It feels like the truth. I mean, and let me express what I mean. I'm Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm the writer. I'm the individual, right? But I am part of something larger, and I've always felt myself as part of something larger. I have a tradition. I have ancestry. I have heritage. What that means is that I do whatever I do within the time that I have in my life, whatever time I'm gifted with. And much of what I do is built on what other people did before then. And then after that, I leave the struggle where I leave it. And then hopefully it's in a bad place. Oftentimes it's not. That's the history, in fact. And then my progeny pick it up and they keep it going. I am descended from people who in their lifetime fought with all their might for the destruction of chattel slavery in this country. And they never saw it. They never saw it. In my personal belief system, they died in, you know, defeat, in darkness, you know? And so I guess the privilege that I draw out of this, the honor that I draw out of this, is not that things will necessarily be better in my lifetime, but that I will make the contribution that I am supposed to make. The fact of the matter is, you know, as horrifying as, you know, the killing of Charlie Kirk was, and as horrifying as the feeling is, this moment that we are in, you know, an era of political violence, and I don't want to sound flip here, political violence is the norm for the black experience in this country. It just is. I don't even mean like the Malcolm X, Martin Luther King variety of it, right? Which is the norm too. You would be hard pressed to have a conversation with a black person in this country that is a descendant of slavery and not have them be able to reach maybe right here or to tell you themselves, look, my uncle, my grandfather, my great grandfather, they lived in a small town in Mississippi, in Tennessee, in Alabama. They got into some sort of dispute with a white man and either they were lynched or we had to run. Political violence runs through us. It is our heritage. Is that good? No. Do we valorize it? Absolutely not. Do we minimize it? Absolutely not. But a life free of it is not a thing that's really in reach in my time.
Sometimes I think that having a historical scope that wide can make the present too deterministic. Mm. So to me, I look at the last, 8, 12 years. Mm-hmm. And what I see having happened is we, the coalition I am in, the things I believe in, lost ground. And people determinedly worked to make that so. Charlie Kirk worked to make that so successfully, right? I think that when he began going to college campuses and putting out a sign at a table, what he was eventually going to build was not obvious, right? I think he worked. I think he was a successful political actor. And I think that from when in 2016, we lost to Donald Trump the first time, very narrowly, won the popular vote, right? And then in 2020, we almost lost to him and began seeing we were losing a bunch of voters we thought we were fighting for, right? Losing more working class voters, losing non-white voters, right? Something was changing, but we won, so okay. And then in 2024, we really got our asses handed to us. And we let a much more dangerous form of politics fully erupt. And I think that reflects strategic decisions they made. I think it reflects decisions we made. So I think for me, it's not enough to say, we lost, their backlashes, sometimes you lose. I think it requires like a very fundamental rethinking, like a disciplined strategic rethinking of what have we been doing? Why are people preferring this to us? And I do think that is like, it opens up into something more. That I think that there is a practice of politics here that in a narrow sense, I was talking about Kirk, but in a broad sense reflects to something that I thought was going to be an argument stretching across the show for like a year, mm-hmm. right? I think more of it came out in this than I'd intended probably. But I think it meant...
Honest question, in 2025, how many of the 14% of Black Americans are direct descendants of the slaves? Aren't many now second or third generation immigrants from Black countries? My guess is going to be the vast majority of Black Americans here, I'm going to guess 80% plus, are descendants of slaves. I don't know if anybody has the number to that. I'd be curious to see. It's not also that you're like always like a descendant of a slave and stuff. I think that kind of racism can be more pervasive in kind of a more insidious manner and a more subversive manner too. Like, I think a really great example was there was the quote that the journalist shouldn't have wrote this quote because it wasn't strictly true, saying that Charlie Kirk was saying that all Black women were unqualified or stupid or whatever, or couldn't be a position. And then that one conservative tweet was like, find me the quote. He never said that. And the actual quote was Charlie Kirk naming off like four of the most accomplished Black women like who are alive in the United States and saying that they were stupid and unqualified for their positions. Like, in a way, that statement is even worse. But yeah, I don't know. It's a thing. It's a thing in the U.S. And I think something that probably happens with Black people, it even happens with me, where if I hear somebody say something, there are just so many little things that like I'm like not sure. Like if somebody were to kind of like laugh, it's like, oh, did you get the COVID booster or whatever? I think even if somebody just said the phrase COVID booster, I would be like, what do you mean by that? Tell me about that. What do you mean by COVID booster? That would just make me wonder. And I'm sure for Black people, that's like expanded like a million times more, where there are different sayings, there are different like expressions, there are just positions and stances where you're not sure. I think especially, now you've got to try really hard to divorce this from the white Black people. And these are the 18 to 22 year old Black people who are on college campuses, who are in these TikTok groups okay, I'm just kidding, half kidding, 20% kidding. 40% kidding. But like in just ordinary day-to-day life, I think a lot of this kind of like weird racist stuff can be a lot more pervasive than it seems. And keep in mind too, that you would only have to interact with something like this like once every couple of days or once a week or once a month to make it feel like it's more in your life than it might even be, or more than you actually realize it. And it is more than, you even see. So yeah, it's just a thing. And the recent comments and positions by a lot of conservatives and MAGA don't help that thing.
Across the show for like a year, mm-hmm. right? I think more of it came out in this than I'd intended probably. But I think in many ways we've stopped doing politics. We've written a lot of people off. And in writing them off, we are losing and we are unable to protect ourselves, unable to protect them, just unable to make good change in the world.
Can you say more about that writing them off, please?
Yeah. Why don't we start it here if we want to talk about writing off? I've been obsessing recently for a piece I've been writing about the Hillary Clinton deplorables comment, and I want to play it.
You know, just being grossly journalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
There's a bad question that you can ask about this, and there's a good question that you can ask about this. Let's see which one Ezra Klein asks.
Right? The racist, sexist, homophobe.
The bad question you can ask about this is, why would Hillary say something like that? What does it say about us that we would champion a political leader saying something like that about the other side? That's the stupid question that you can ask. The good question is, why is it that Trump could say something 100 times worse and nobody on the right would care and everyone on the left would just accept it? That's the good question to ask. Let's see which one, let's see which direction Ezra Klein takes here.
Xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up. He has given voice to their websites that used to only have 11,000 people, now have 11 million. He tweets and retweets. They're offensive, hateful, mean-spirited rhetoric. Now, some of those folks, they are irredeemable, but thankfully, they are not American.
What do you think when you hear that?
She probably shouldn't have said it.
You think it's true?
I mean, it's probably not how I would say it, but, you know, I mean, there are things that I would say, mm-hmm. you know? I probably would say what I said earlier, you know, in the interview about the force of, and as I've been saying this probably since as long as we've been talking,
yeah.
you know, but I'm not, I just want to be clear about something. I shouldn't be running for president of the United States. You know what I mean? And my expectations for the rhetoric of writers, intellectuals, journalists, et cetera, is very, very different than what the expectation should be for people who expect to hold office.
Yeah, so I agree with, right? I think that there are different jobs in all this. But when I say we began writing people off, mm-hmm. I think that's something that happened, and I think something I saw in this debate, but kind of like underneath it.
See, you're not asking the right questions. Like, conservatives don't think about this. Donald Trump and the Republicans have no problem casting the entire opposite side as literally like it's a war of good and evil. It's enemies of America. It's enemies of the movement. They're not thinking about these questions. Why are you?
Was the work of politics of bridging over a lot of profound, fundamental moral disagreements. I think it became somewhat demeaned, diminished, began to seem like in many cases of betrayal to people. The tent shrunk. The people I feel more comfortable with wielding power shrunk. Mm. And I think what Clinton was saying there came from somewhere. It came from, you know, the sort of culture that had emerged. It got worse over time. And I think it really contributed to us losing. And meanwhile, this is why when I say, like in that initial piece, there was something that I respected in what Kirk was doing, like going in, having debates, using them opportunistically. A lot of people throw them back at me that, oh, he wasn't debating to find truth. Of course he wasn't debating to find the truth. He was doing politics. He was trying to persuade people. And I've watched on our side, not opportunistic engagement, but a lot of, I would say, counterproductive disengagement.
Would you like to see one of us put up a sign outside of, say, some white evangelical church in Alabama, debate me on abortion, and then use that content to say such and such smashes, you know what I mean, church parishioner here, such and such owns
I would like to see.
Would you like
I would
to
like
see
to see people on our side. Yeah, go to evangelical churches, go to places where that feel unfriendly, have conversations. And look, I put things up on YouTube. They're fairly successful, not the best of the business. And I don't use, you know, capital letters destroys in them. I think you can do it more aligned to hopefully our value structure, our political approach, our political aesthetic, at least one that I believe in. I shouldn't overuse the term our here. But we weren't doing that either.
I don't know that we weren't. I don't know if it's on YouTube anymore, but I received an invitation, for instance, I think about when I went up to West Point and I had to go there and talk about Between the World and Me. I had to challenge them very, very directly about what it meant to have at that time Confederate memorials up there and to, you know, talk about, you know, a Confederate. I can't remember, you know, what the motto is exactly, but basically it's an argument against lying and what it meant, you know, to have that there and have those grand historical lies. I mean, we had a really, really great interaction. I don't know that, you know, I know everybody didn't agree with me. It would never occur to me. And I think it actually insults the dialogue to take that and say, Ta-Nehisi owns West Point Cadets.
Not recognize the kind of culture I'm talking about here? Like, really? I think there really was a move towards the sort of approach Clinton is offering here. I think we began to pull back. I really do.
But maybe it would help if you define
I will define the word, like, right? Because I actually think this is a very hard thing about talking about political parties.
Right.
Because they're diffuse.
Right.
Right. It's a lot of people doing a lot of things all at once. But I think of the huge backlash to Bernie Sanders for going on Joe Rogan's show. Because Rogan was transphobic, right? Such a big backlash. When I defended him, I became myself a Twitter trending topic.
Right.
To Elizabeth Warren for going on Bill Maher's show. Bill Maher's Islamophobic.
Right.
There were protests at Netflix when they brought on Dave Chappelle. Right. I think there was a politics of content moderation that took hold that was more about enforcing boundaries of what, you know, were and were not ideas we should be engaged with than about engaging them again, even if opportunistically. And when
that's not unique, though, Ezra. You want to talk about a policy of, like, I can't even believe I'm saying this, but Donald Trump is literally tweeting out multiple comedians that he fucking hates. Two, almost, that he got deplatformed, right? Colbert, arguably. They announced this guy's show cancellation 8 months ahead of time because Trump is tweeting about how much he hates him. Jimmy Kimmel, hardcore pressured off and now is back. But like, this isn't like the Democratic side isn't even remotely close to this level of insane overt pressure. The largest, I think the largest doxing list ever created was probably that, what is it, charliesmurderers.com or whatever. It's just, this is like not a unique thing on the left.
I go back to something I was saying to you a minute ago. I am in a process right now thinking we failed, right? We lost. The loss is having terrible consequences. What do we need to rethink? How do we become competitive again in places where we're not? And I think there is something in here. Do people feel like, even if they disagree with us on some things, that they have a place with us? And my experience going around the country talking to people, I've been on a lot of, you know, right of center podcasts lately, is that, you know, rightly or wrongly, like what they took and something that really empowered Trump in the last election was a sense that they didn't. And like, we were against them. And so they were going to be against us. And I think that's, in the end, doing politics badly.
So I think two things. Yeah. I think about how much you argued that like Biden shouldn't run again. What if he doesn't earlier and you have a Democrat who wins the presidency? You know, like the other big explainers that I can see for it, you know what I mean? That don't feel so diffuse. You know, the other thing is, and I know you don't want to talk historically, but, you know, when you say fatalism, like I take that to mean that what's the point of fighting? But I think that misapprehends the philosophy here. You don't.
Why is Destiny nuclear on Ezra? I'm not nuclear on him. I just think that people don't see sometimes what the other side is doing. And their suggestions or strategies for being successful on their side come from how they wish politics would be and not what politics actually is. And it's modeled after, in their mind, they've modeled what the most effective political party would be. The Democratic Party is not living up to it, but the Republican Party doesn't even try to do that. It's like this all, like, we need to be just a little bit more empathetic. Like, different strategies work at different points in history and in different environments with different people, right? All of it is variable. It just depends on what's going on, you know? Like, I've had conservatives DM me and say, oh, your conversation with Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro, you know, was really nice. You know, you were a nicer person, so I came and watched your shit. Like, I've had that happen. I've also had a lot of people that used to email me and say things like, bro, when you annihilated Sargon of Akkad or whatever else, like, I personally felt like an idiot. Like, I didn't enjoy that. It made me feel personally uncomfortable. And, you know, I had to reach out and, you know, follow your stuff for a little bit because I wanted to see you get, you know, smashed by some other conservative commentator, and it didn't happen. And, you know, now I'm a fan, or I moved, you know, further to the Nazi camp, whatever Hassan says I would be able to. But no, yeah, it, like there's like different, all these strategies can find success in different ways. There's not just one way to do it.
It's not that you know what's going to happen. It's not that you know Donald Trump is going. It's that you don't underestimate what you are up against. You know, it's actually kind of the opposite. I mean, man, you just wrote these articles about how high the level of racial resentment was. This country, or some segment of it, was so, as the term was used at the time, racially resentful. I call it racist, but race, that it flooded down to Barack Obama's dog, Bo. Mm-hmm. That's not a small amount of power. Like, that's not a small force. And so, you know, just really quickly getting back to Charlie Kirk, like, I would watch those clips of him saying those things, man, and I would see how people would cheer and get charged by it. People get activated by hate. It's a very, very, very strong force. And so I don't think it requires you to feel that you will eventually lose. On the contrary, I think it requires you to feel that even if you do lose, you have this kind of steadfastness, you know what I mean, to keep going.
So I think this is a great point. And I think I really saw it. In some ways more in Trump's first term, but I see it now too, which is, the worse, from your perspective, from my perspective, the other side gets, the more people want their reaction to sort of be, and their strategy to be emotionally consonant with how they're feeling about it. Because these people are so bad, there can be no corner, right? I had somebody we both know, I'll say an eminent academic of one form or another.
If that's the case, the different strategies are more effective at different points in time. Do you think it's a sense of, it feels like regression of progress of the USA experiment? Well, the regression comes from, and I know people get triggered when I say this, but it there is the lack of tit for tat on the Democratic side. It's the fact that if you excuse or allow for so much deplorable behavior on the conservative side, then they're going to continue to engage in it. And the conservative political project has not really suffered at all or been punished at all for the insane political gambles. I shouldn't even say gambles, but just the insane political shit that they've gotten away with, whether it was the Ken Starr, Monica Lewinsky thing, I've said it all these a million times, whether it was the Al Gore presidential election thing in the Supreme Court, whether it was McConnell stealing a pick from Obama, whether it was Trump trying to overthrow the Republic in 2020, like the Conservative Party politically, whether it was all the lies and everything related to Dominion and Fox News, the multiple impeachments of Donald Trump, like they just haven't paid a political price for this. And if they haven't going forward, even if we win the next election, why wouldn't they just repeat the same strategies, right? They might as well. There's no drawback to it. And that's partially on the Democrats for not enforcing some type of punitive measure there.
Other. Okay. email me after these pieces and just say to me, like, we are not on the same side anymore. Right. The what I was doing was too far. Right. Like, mm-hmm. we are just not on the same side. If I could say these things. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling right now that we are closer to genuine national rupture. Certainly been in my lifetime. Right. The idea that this experiment, that America could topple into something else, into something much worse, into some kind of new extended regime, feels very real to me. Right. I remember when I was on the Why We're Polarized book tour. The end of that book is this recitation of what happened in the 1960s, mm-hmm. the political assassinations, the violence in the streets, like what the state was doing, what was happening. But on the book tour, what I would say is my nightmare scenario is that level of violence and fracture with these kinds of parties, mm-hmm. where politics is not a, for all of its flaws, a calming force, because like the views are diffuse across the two parties, but an accelerant. And I think we're much more now in the world I was fearing. Okay, so that's, I think it should make you think, okay, what is some kind of de-escalation before you get to rupture look like? But the other is that there are a lot of people who live in places we used to win not that long ago. So I'm thinking about Obamacare. When Obamacare passes, there are Democratic senators in Arkansas, in Louisiana, in West Virginia, in Missouri, in Indiana, in North Carolina, in South Dakota, in North Dakota. And I've been thinking that I think for a lot of us, to twist the line about capitalism, it has become easier to imagine the end of the country than winning a Senate seat in Missouri or Arkansas. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah. So I think a couple things about that. First of all, I just want to bring in the historical perspective. Not that long ago, I can remember when Obama won.
Can the Democrats enact any punitive measures without feeding into the narrative of MAGA? Why can't we have our own narrative? Why does it why does everything have to be framed from their control of the entire media landscape from top to bottom?
And I believe you would remember this too. And there were all of these pieces about the end of conservatism and the end of the Republican Party. You don't know how it's going to go. Nobody really. It doesn't mean you shouldn't think about how it's going to go. Yeah.
And in 05, there were all these pieces about the end of the Democratic Party.
Yes, it was.
Right? Democrats had lost touch with the heartland.
Yeah.
Right? They were never going
to
get it back.
That's right. And so I think it's always like important to keep that in the background. Look, I have, just in terms of bridging gaps and everything, I have a basic level of respect that I accord to everybody. You know what I mean? I want to say what I have to say. I don't want to shrink back from it. You know what I mean? But I do think on a basic level, there's a respect that has to be had for people that I disagree with, right? At the same time, I recognize that part of my audience, and I would say an important part of my audience, is people who have never enjoyed that respect. You know what I mean? People who, in fact, are subjects of the kind of hate that Charlie Kirk was harvesting. And I can't ever, A, contribute to making them feel like they've been abandoned, and B, I can't ever stand by and watch somebody do that. And in the name of unity or whatever, act like that's not happening, because there are real consequences. And so it's like, when I read his words towards trans people, Jesus, when I read, you know what I mean, the language towards Haitians specifically, which was very, very, Haitians will become your masters if you don't elect Trump. I mean, this is very, very familiar to me. You know, it's this idea of Haitians coming into the country or immigrants raping your daughters. I mean, this was really, really, really dark stuff. It's at the core of this country. And so I feel like for Haitian immigrants that are in, you know, Ohio, who are living under the weight of this, for trans kids who, you know what I mean, are dealing with, you know, being, I don't even want to use the term bully, beaten up, attacked, threatened. You know what I mean? It's very, very important to me, given the post I have, to say, I see you, but also this dude was wrong. And I'm all for unifying. I'm all for.
The problem is that there are no big issues that the left is advocating for right now, at least nothing with a good catchphrase. That's because every single thing that the left does has to be defensively from the Republicans. Like, I think you can advocate strongly for things. I think you should find things that are good to message on and would be good for the country. And you can bring them up over and over again. And you can use a point like the upcoming shutdown to do it. Like, not sending troops everywhere, I think, is something that most Americans could agree on. I don't know what this agreement would look like, if it would be a new piece of legislation signed by Congress or something. But, like, this should be a non-negotiable. Trump making just like a speech where he has to disavow all violence from both sides without blaming one or the other, I think that should be non-negotiable. And I think forcing Trump and his family members to divest from, at the very least, untraceable financial transactions like the crypto stuff, I think that's also a no-brainer. Like, these are three things that are no-brainers, but we don't talk about it ever in the media ever, because the Republicans control all the talking points. So we don't get to have debates on any of these things. I think using the shutdown as an opportunity to force these talking points and then let them try to divert all they want as the government is shut down, and keep it shut down and let the country go to shit if they can't, like, force them to talk about it. I think, and I'm sure you could find other things here too. These are three things that I like. I'm sure there are other things you could find. If they want to do the Medicaid stuff, I think that's probably an easy one to fight on. But like, this is the opportunity, the upcoming shutdown, I think, is hopefully the opportunity to force, like, some kind of attention. The Democrats just need to be unified in their messaging, and they can't be backstabbing each other constantly on the media with a whole bunch of liberal simps looking to get brownie points from independents and center-right losers by constantly second-guessing and undermining their own side. It has to be a strong, democratic, unified response. And also, like, in a vacuum, all of this shit should be the easiest, most agreeable shit ever. Hey, your family shouldn't be able to take untraceable, unknown amounts of money through cryptocurrency. As the president of the United States, you can't do that. Okay, that should be an easy... How the fuck do you even... I haven't even heard a positive argument on the other end of this because Republicans have never had to defend it. They've never, ever, 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 ever had to defend this thing, right? Why can't Donald Trump say every single person needs to be less violent in this country? All of us need to calm the fuck down. Why is nobody having this conversation with him, right? Or the agreement, you can't be militarizing all of the National Guard and sending it without governor's consent into states to do crime enforcement. These are three super easy things. All three of these are evidence of oligarchical fascism, right? The idea of using the military against your own fucking citizens. The idea of championing violence on your side. When the brown shirts do it, it's great. When the other side do it, it's bad. Like, these are words that Trump has said verbatim. And then the secret money shit from donors and stuff that we literally have no insight into whatsoever. These are three super easy gimmies. And again, I'm sure you can find others. Maybe it wouldn't be those three, but like this is, I think that the shutdown is the point to force that fight, in my opinion.
Bridging gaps, but not at the expense of my neighbor's humanity. I just can't.
I think this, the thing we go to there, right? Not at the expense of my neighbor's humanity. Because I've gotten a lot of that in email, right? Like, how am I supposed to talk to these people? How am I supposed to deal with these people who are denying my humanity?
I'm not against talking to them, but I'll talk to you very clearly.
Yeah, sure.
I have no problem with that.
I guess the place where, I'm not even 100% sure if we disagree, if you just like sort of see your role differently, mm-hmm. right? I think that in losing as badly as we have imperiled trans people terribly.
Yes.
Politics is for power.
Joe Biden did that.
What are you talking about? When you claim the moral high ground, you fight with one hand tied because you must respect the guardrails of society. But if both sides abandon those guardrails, the system collapses and descends into chaos. No. You think that the Republicans don't claim that they have the moral high ground? Like, you understand that they don't frame it the same way that you frame it, right? The Republicans don't see themselves as, well, we're fighting dirty, and the other side is the one with the moral high ground. No, everybody sees themselves in the moral high ground. It is definitionally so. Everyone has their own moral high ground. Everybody claims the moral high ground. Like, tautologically, that's almost always going to be the case. Nobody views, even Nazis don't view themselves as being evil.
Your role differently, mm-hmm. right? I think that in losing as badly as we have, we have imperiled trans people terribly.
Yes.
Politics is for power.
Joe Biden did that.
Politics is for power. And so...
Wait, what did Joe Biden do?
I think that the question I am just genuinely struggling with isn't how to have like a great kumbaya moment. But I think it is taking seriously that something we're doing is not working. I mean, I had Sarah McBride, who's the first trans member of Congress on the show. And, you know, she was talking, we were talking.
I'm guessing he wanted him to drop out of the election sooner. Maybe. Which may or may not have been a good... I don't know. Maybe it would have been. Who knows?
Oh, every single survey you can offer on like trans rights has gone in the wrong direction the past couple of years. Right? We've just begun to lose that argument terribly. And that has put people in real danger. So I take your point when you say, look, I want people to feel seen in my writing. And I want people to feel seen in my writing and my podcasting. But I think the place I'm trying to push towards is I think that there is a diminishment of the political coalition building that we now need to do because we have come to the view that a pretty wide variety of people are in some ways kind of deplorables. I think it's weakened in the last couple of years.
I would never use that language. Jesus Christ.
But
like I said, so when you're asking
about this building that we now need to do because we have come to the view that a pretty wide variety of people are in some ways kind of deplorables. I think it's weakened in the last couple of years.
I would never use that language. Jesus Christ.
But
like I said, so when you're asking about that Hillary Clinton, that's what, like, I would never say it like that.
That's great. I think it's good that you wouldn't say it like that, but I'm not saying
I don't even think that, by the way. Like, I don't.
Like, this is just so funny to me to see two liberals be like, man. I would call these people deplorables. What? Deplorables? Meanwhile, Donald Trump and everybody, I hate my enemy. The Democrats are evil. It's like, okay, Jesus Christ.
Like, I don't even focus on people. That, look, I am at war with certain ideologies and ideas, and I want them expunged. I want to turn them into phrenology. That's what I want. Uh-huh. But I don't want the people, you know what I mean, out. Like, when you start talking about who people are and their bones, like that...
So in a way, I'm not sure. I mean, in a way, I think we're saying something not too dissimilar here. Mm-hmm. I guess the place where I felt a lot of pushback, and maybe this was not your pushback, right? Mm-hmm. Was, you know, the first piece I can just sort of, like, I accept that there's a disagreement on, like, what to do in the 24 hours after a death. Like, you feel like I was whitewashing the guy, and I felt like I was sort of...
I do.
Yeah, I know you do.
I
know
it was
do.
Very upsetting.
I know you do. The second piece I did, which I think you saw, was more about this question of, what are we going to do living here in sort of two types of disagreement? Right. One with a right that has, where Tyler Cook has become sort of the center of it, right? He's not unusual for the MAGA coalition. He's a sort of uniting force within it. and the kind of things he believed and the way he did his politics. And then two, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to be here? People are like halfway there, right? What does it mean to be in this political community together? What do you think about that question?
About how to live together?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I think it's a truth. You know what I mean? I think it's a, you know, like it's a foregone, like we are. You know, I really, really believe that, you know? There's no real choice about this. You know, I'm not renouncing my American citizenship. They're not renouncing their American citizenship. So this then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is a contest of ideas and narratives. Again, all I can go through is my role as a writer. And my role as a writer is to state things as clearly as I possibly can to make them.
People are saying, how could this guy have a problem with Ezra whitewashing the gun and square that with being this way about the political? Well, he's probably, this guy, to be fair, when he was saying this, he was probably talking about like political effectiveness and so on. But I'm just saying that like conservatives would never have this conversation about political effectiveness. They would just call him evil. But I don't think this guy's saying, I don't think he's being ultra soy.
In such a way that they haunt to state truths and to reinforce the probably the animating notion of my politics. And that is that all humanity is equal and is worthy of that. You know, and I actually think all of the sort of political and policy positions are, you know, that I probably find myself in sympathy with are attempting to affect that, you know, in the real world. And so, and again, I'm putting aside your piece, but I'm just you know, thinking about the moment we're in. When I hear or see people who are honored and commemorated in such a way so that they almost become a national religious figure, and then I see their content, and I see that their content is actively destructive to humanity, I have to draw a line there. Like, I think, like, for me, like, the bigger question is, where are the lines? You know what I mean? And I think there's no problem with saying, listen, you can't hurl epithets at people. You're out if you do that. I'm sorry. Look, you want to have a debate about whether we should have affirmative action, you know, in colleges? I'm here for it. You want to have
But what does it mean to be on the other side of the line?
I'm sorry, what do you mean?
What is it? So, once somebody's on the other side of the line,
right?
What does that mean for you?
For instance, once you think it's okay to...
No.
So,
well, yeah,
I'm trying to make this clear.
Yeah, no, I am too.
Yes.
Once, for whatever the definition of the line is,
right?
What does it mean for you for somebody to be on the other side of it? Right? Not somebody who just died.
Right.
But somebody still living.
Right. If you think it is okay to dehumanize people, then conversation between...
He's trying to make a Fed post.
You and I is probably not possible.
And so what do you do with the fact that so many people think that is okay?
I think what you try to do is, again, this is the difference, right? Like, I don't necessarily have the crystal ball to say that in this time, I'm going to be able to convince a majority of people that, for instance, let's just take the thing that's hot right now, trans folks are human beings and deserve humanity. Although I think most people know that you shouldn't say what he said. Like, that shit is rude. It's just rude to talk to people like that. And I think most people know that. So as I'm thinking my way through the...
Was it Pam Bondi or was it Marjorie Taylor Greene? Or I feel like I was watching some Senate or House committee where they literally refer to this person over and over again as like a tranny. And they just like openly do it because it's epic. And it's like, I don't think these people give a
question. I actually think that's not a hard line to draw. You know, I think not calling people out of their
Nancy
name.
Oh, Nancy Mace.
I think that's actually a basic value that most draw. You know, I think not calling people out of their name, I think that's actually a basic value that most people have. And I think people who think it's not, who are pushing that, actually themselves on the other side of the line.
But so I want to hold on this for a minute. I do think this is like a very like
And that's core different
question.
From policy, Ezra.
Yeah, I understand like, it's different than policy.
That's different than policy.
I think that one wondrous reality is the president of the United States is a person who in his comportment as a human being on the public stage, I would have said in 08, in 12, in 16, should be on the other side of the line.
Yeah.
I think he's a person who does not act with any sense of public or even personal decency.
Right.
And then he won in 16, you know, lost sort of narrowly in 20 and then won in 2024. And I think the thing that has led to for me is recognizing that I don't get to draw the line. Now, it doesn't mean I don't have one in my own heart, but I think that is the thing that I am struggling with, which is not only is he clearly for most people or a lot of people, plurality of the voters in the last election, not somehow way over the line, but like, that means it's a lot of people who are willing to accept things that I thought we would have found unacceptable. Like, I really, if you had told me, like, I would.
There's also, I don't know how we got mind f***ed into believing this. And maybe I don't know if I've ever been f***ed into believing this. The idea that, like, we need to appeal to moderates, okay? We do need to appeal to moderates. We need to appeal to the moderate left, okay? We don't need to try to capture MAGA. I don't know where that thought process or that belief came from, that we have to do something to pull those other people on our side. We don't need that. We have plenty of people on our side. We have plenty of voters on our side. Just mobilize them. And if you want, throw a bone to the retarded independents in this country every now and then. But that's it. Appeal to your base. Turn out your base, your moderate base, not the fucking wackos, the Hassan terrorist types or whatever. Throw a bone to the independents every now and then and appeal to and bring out your base. And that's it. The idea that we have to focus so much of our political messaging around appealing to the insane lunatics who no longer believe in vaccines or medicine, like, we're good.
That means it's a lot of people who are willing to accept things that I thought we would have found unacceptable. Like, I really, if you had told me, like, I would have thought that the way he acts in public is unacceptable, and it's not. And so I think for me, and this goes back to maybe the culture that you feel didn't exist, but I feel did, that there was a view that we could sort of work with politics with drawing these lines, that there are people going to be inside them and outside them, and we could work that way. And I think that I am like working with the question of what happens if you don't believe that, if you don't control the line. What I see is any line that existed at all collapsing. So I'm watching like Holocaust revisionism on like the biggest right-wing podcasts,
right?
I'm watching Tucker Carlson like turn into, you know, what I would describe as a white nationalist and become an absolute dominant force on the right, like bigger than he ever was in his, you know, smarmy libertarian phase. And this stuff is real appeal, like as you said, right? That's not a surprise on some level. It's just something you have to deal with. And so that's where this question of the line drawing, like I have lines where I think should and should not be acceptable, but those lines clearly have no relationship to my country, the politics. And I think I've been asking the question without really having an answer. I want to be honest about this, of what follows from that.
I think you do have a line. I'm sure I do. I think there are things, for instance, that I could say that would make you say it's no point in Ta-Nehisi coming up on and being on this podcast.
What is a stupid saying? I'm tweeting that. Has somebody else already? I don't know if I need a picture to go on. When the lib cell says something so Trump phobic that you give him that median voter smile. Oh my God.
And likewise, there are things you could say, obviously, I would say there's no point in me talking to Ezra.
Yeah. I'm saying what happens if 35% of the country, 40% of the country, the dominant political force in the country is inside that? Does that change anything? Or no, like the line just holds?
No, I mean, welcome to Black America. That's our history. The line we have drawn in general has not been majoritarian politics, unfortunately. That's just been what it is, you know? And at the time that it's been majoritarian politics, people have done things and, you know, fiddled with government or done, you know, extremely violent things to make it not so, you know?
How do you deal in that answer? Like, how do you deal with Trump really substantially increasing his share of the black vote?
Actually, I think where he is about where actually Republicans tended to be before Barack Obama. So I'm a little less. I mean, there's a conservative portion of our community that's always voted Republican. And I think, you know, obviously, I think sexism is a very, very real force. You know, I don't think it's completely explanatory, but the idea that there is, say, 20% of black men who are fundamentally conservative, that doesn't really surprise me too much.
But I guess let's take, because I think this is a hard, like a hard case. I think from your perspective and from my perspective, we probably don't believe hugely different things. Mm-hmm. A huge amount of the country, right? A majority of the country believes things about trans people, about what policy should be towards trans people, about what language is acceptable to trans people, that like we would see as fundamentally morally wrong.
Right.
And what politically, not in a column or something, but politically, should our relationship with those people be? Do we win them over? Do we compromise with them? Like this feels like a very salient question. The Republican Party is going to make sure this is a relentlessly salient question.
Right.
So
I agree with that.
Where does the approach leave us? Right. Where do we go on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. Look, I think a couple things. I think... Again, look, my tradition is the only thing I have a reference point for, so I'm sorry to keep going back to this. But
like, why do we have to talk more about our trans people than the right has to talk about their Nazis? In what world do we have to strategize around answering for trans athletes? There are like 12 of them. But the right can ignore Candace Owens. Like, what the fuck?
When I look at the times that we have lost, if I think specifically about the black tradition, for instance, it's hard for me to say politically they did something wrong. You know what I mean? Like Reconstruction falls. What was the thing that should have been done? On the contrary, I see, you know, a kind of courage that I wish we had today in a lot of people. You know what I mean? I see people willing to die and take bullets all the time. You know what I mean? What more could Ida B. Wells have done, you know, to get the anti-lynching bill passed? I mean, here's somebody that, you know, was banished from Tennessee on threat of being killed after she saw her friends, you know, murdered and lynched. And one of the things I will say is when I look back at that long tradition, and I look back in the times that people have won and the places they've won, it's often not been their heroism that was the decisive factor ultimately. It's often not been their strategy that was the decisive factor. Folks look back at the civil rights movement, for instance, and they talk about how brilliant it was to do the sit-ins and, you know what I mean, use mass media in the way that Martin Luther King used mass media, the appearance. All of that's true. But if we don't have World War II, you know what I mean, and the planet does not get a view of how horrific it can be when you decide you're going to eliminate people based on their traits, civil rights movement happened? I don't know. I think windows open and close.
Isn't that a counter to your primary claim about Assan, though? How can Assan be such a destructive force for Dems in your eyes, but Candace Owens isn't for the GOP? Because Candace Owens, at the end of the day, will still play ball with the GOP and will never pull people away from the GOP's candidate. Hassan fundamentally, and tankies fundamentally, socialist types or commies are destructive forces that will never work with the Democratic Party. Like, do you think Candace Owens is out here saying, I don't know, guys, maybe you should vote for Kamala, right? Or it doesn't matter who you vote for in this election. No. These people are always hard bought into the, because they're playing politics, they're always hard bought into the conservative candidate.
And so I think some of this is up to the decisions that politicians make. I think some of it is also up to what is happening in the broader mass culture at the time. I think all this kind of, you know, works together. I'm not against, you know, this kind of strategizing. I think that has to happen. But I think you also have to.
They also, like, even though they're like radical fringes of that movement, I don't see them on some issues. Maybe they will, like on the Israel thing lately, maybe. But they generally don't fixate on the both sides stuff. Usually they're attacking the left, like the Candace Owens and the Nick Fuentes types. Fuentes maybe not as much lately because of the Charlie Kirk stuff. But on the far left, I don't know, maybe these guys are attacking Trump more and I'm just missing it. But it feels to me like they have a lot to say about everybody and the Democrats. And then everybody in both sides.
You know, works together. I'm not against, you know, this kind of strategizing. I think that has to happen. But I think you also have to recognize like how broad the world is when you say politics.
I think that you have actually been a very prime mover in this. I think there's been a period, particularly on the left, in which the Civil War, post it, the writings of that time, the people.
Oh, new Trump post. Hold on.
You can revolutionize senior health care.
How?
We've all heard about the major systems in our bodies,
okay,
like the digestive, respiratory, nervous, and cardiovascular systems.
Okay.
But there's one essential system discovered in the 90s that you probably never heard of.
The magnetic system.
It makes all of the other systems work smoothly with each other. Like a conductor ensuring the different sections of an orchestra play a beautiful symphony together. This system is called the endocannabinoid system.
Oh, fuck.
It has been acknowledged and studied by scientists extensively with support from the National Institutes of Health.
Okay.
As we age, the system weakens.
Oh, no.
As a result, the different systems in our body stop working together smoothly.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons older adults struggle with pain, inflammation, cognitive decline, and other ailments of aging.
Damn.
For which doctors often prescribe dangerous and addictive pharmaceuticals. They also recommend lifestyle remedies, such as exercise, good diet, and
that's not going to help me, though. I need some fucking THC or some CBD.
Stress management. And while all these improve the system, it is only fractionally and over a long time. But here's the game changer. The system can be restored faster using hemp-derived CBD.
Yes!
When the system is restored, pain subsides.
Oh, my God.
Sleep is improved.
They're healthy.
And stress is reduced. When the system is restored, disease progression can slow down, and years are added to your life, as well as years spent in good health. And 20% of seniors are already using CBD today for pain, arthritis, cancer symptoms,
holy
sleep
shit.
Disorders, Alzheimer's, and many other ailments
Huntington's?
Of aging.
Metabolism?
But doctors
oh my
are
God.
Not equipped to provide guidance. And there are no FDA standards for what is already in the market today. Imagine if that were the case for other medications. Older adults are suffering needlessly.
No.
Hemp-derived CBD can help them feel better, live longer,
look at her
and
go.
Improve their quality of life significantly.
Look at him go.
A PricewaterhouseCoopers report estimates annual cost savings for the U.S. nearly $64 billion a year if cannabis is fully integrated into the healthcare system.
Oh, shit.
The groundbreaking 2018 Farm Bill, championed by President Trump, was the first step. Now it's time to educate doctors on the endocannabinoid system, provide Medicare coverage for CBD, and give millions of seniors the support they deserve. You will deliver the most important senior health initiative of the century, cementing your legacy and transforming aging care. Millions everywhere will thank you.
Why doesn't he just, like, Trump could unilaterally legalize weed right now, right? It's only a Schedule I drug because the DEA says it. Trump's the head of the government. He could just do it. Does he know that he could just do that? That maybe he doesn't know that, actually. He could just do that.
A rooting period, a place where we sort of go back and look and think about who are we, what was revealed about us. I'm taking nothing away from that.
Right.
But that's obviously a period where politics ultimately fails. I actually think, and I've thought about this a lot in reaction I have read in the last couple of weeks, I've thought a lot about how many people believe we are already in a cold civil war, that we are in a time that we are dealing with divisions and questions. I see it on the right, for sure. I hear it on the left. I have a lot of email that's like, we need a national divorce. How that's going to be effectuated, never exactly clear. They do use that.
Do people you respect say that to you?
Well, yes, actually, I will say that. But I'm not going to, people say things to me that are off the record, and I do are already in a cold slot. Get nothing away from that.
Right.
But that's obviously a period where politics ultimately fails. I actually think, and I've thought about this a lot in reaction I have read in the last couple of weeks, I've thought a lot about how many people believe we are already in a cold civil war, that we are in a time that we are dealing with divisions and questions. I see it on the right, for sure. I hear it on the left. I have a lot of email that's like, we need a national divorce. How that's going to be effectuated, never exactly clear.
Do people you respect say that to you?
Well, yes, actually, I will say that. But I'm not going to, people say things to me that are off the record and I shouldn't say it. But you don't believe that though, right? You don't believe we are at a point. I think this is really important. I was curious what you'd say to this question. You don't believe we are at a point where our, like, the next 10, 20, 30 years can't be shaped by decisions we would understand is within normal politics, within elections and legislation and organizing and so on.
No.
Good. I think that's great.
I mean, look, that could happen.
Yeah.
That could happen. But I guess the broader thing I am thinking about is, how much does this era stand out in the long sweep of American history?
Yeah.
It's bad.
Well, so this is actually...
But it wouldn't make my list for worse.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I'm where you are on this, right. To just be okay. Super clear.
Okay.
But I actually think one reason then the amount we focus on the Civil War period mm-hmm. is tricky is because that's a period when it didn't work like that, right? You actually had to go over the cliff of that and have the war. I've been thinking a lot about, because I've been reading a lot about McCarthyism. So I've been thinking about that whole period. And you just sort of brought up the World War II as, you know, sort of a generator of the politics that allows us to have the Great Society, the Civil Rights Act, et cetera. I think another way of sort of glossing that is you have the rise of Red Scare politics, which predate McCarthy. You have Joseph McCarthy, who is just for a period an unbelievably dominant force.
It's insane.
Everybody who challenges him loses.
That's right.
He becomes a complete kingmaker. He's eventually boxed out and beaten by Dwight Eisenhower, sort of center-right, you know, very, very anti-communist politician, but who can sort of take the center from McCarthy. But then it's like, what happens next? Nixon, who is the genteel red baiter mm-hmm. to McCarthy's non-genteel mm-hmm. red baiter, runs the next election. He's beaten by JFK, who's a very center-left, very anti-communist, sort of runs to Nixon's right on communism. Mm-hmm. And he does it with Lyndon Johnson, you know, on the bottom of the ticket, sort of representing Southern politics and Democratic Party. It's a very, very, in a way, checkered series of moves. They're accepting huge amounts of McCarthyism at that time. And yet it does sort of lead to political power that is unwielded in a very, very different way within fairly short order.
Something that I'm curious about, it's hard to know without having studied the time period, but something that feels different about what we have now, the thing that was so annoying when Trump came in, especially with the tariff stuff, is regardless of like radical experiences that we've had in the past with segments of the U.S. population being radicalized on certain things, at the very least, it felt like it was in response to real things. Like the civil rights era, if you were a racist white person, like that represented a significant change in the organization and structure of society. Like that was for real, going to be a big shakeup for how you felt things. I felt about things or how you viewed things in America, because things would actually, you know, kind of change. Same thing with, with like the Civil War and the eradication of slavery. Like that was for real, going to change the way that black people associated with and engaged with American society. The Red Scare and the whole McCarthyism stuff was in response to a very real Cold War, a very real opposition that we had with another country. The thing that feels different this time, and I don't know, maybe there are other examples of this, is that like, it feels like some of our fears are like imagined right now. Like when Trump came in, like America's economy and America's position, the world economy, is the envy of the world. And we are terrifying everybody and running away from trade deficits like we're so f-ing afraid of our own shadow. And it's like, none of these other countries are of this position. They're like, oh, we're getting one over on America so much. We're f-ing over so hard with our trade deficits. They're like, oh my God, like America can run this like insanely debt-based government. They still have low treasury bond yields because like they, like everybody else is holding USD. It's literally the petrodollar, the world reserve currency and everything. Every single trade on the planet is like denominated USD almost. It's like, it feels so, I guess it feels different. I'm trying to think of like, I'm not being fair. Maybe like here, this would be a question I would have. Like, I wonder, like in some ways, this can't be true broadly. I'm just saying this because it just popped in my head, but it can't be true broadly. In some ways, it feels like white people today are more afraid of black people now, at least on the crazy mega side, than white people would have been afraid of black people in the 60s. Where like in the 60s, they were like, God, I'm gonna have to work next to these people. They might be my boss. Like, Jesus Christ. Where some white people now are like, oh my God, if black people get all the positions of power, they're gonna white genocide us. We're gonna be eradicated as a people. And it's like, what the f-? Wait, what? How has it gotten worse in some ways? But that can't be. I'm sure there were some white people that felt that way during civil rights. And I'm sure not the majority of MAGA people feel that now. Yeah, I don't know.
I take from this, I've been thinking about this because I think we're sort of in a new McCarthyism, some lessons on how politics can work and like the give and the take of it. We've been sort of brought up the Civil War a bunch, but what do you take from this period?
I take something that we've kind of been circling for this entire conversation, which is that the role of politicians and the role of writers, intellectuals, etc., is very, very different. Politicians do things that I wouldn't do. I don't, for instance, I don't hold JFK or RFK up, you know what I mean, as the people.
Yeah, me neither.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not a fan of JFK Camelot revisionism.
But you know, I guess
not a very good president.
That's like a separate thing from whether, you know what I mean, why politics happens the way they do. Let me give you an instance that often also comes up. That's not the Civil War, and that's the New Deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think there is a pretty strong argument that the New Deal quite did, I mean, not strong argument, but pretty clear that the New Deal did quite a bit to create the social safety net, expand, create an American middle class, right? That's true. Did FDR want to, in his heart, exclude black folks in the way that they were excluded from it? No. That was the price of getting the thing done. I understand that as politics. But were I there in that time, it would be incumbent on me to yell at FDR to not do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's really, 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 really important. We don't all have the same role. You know, when I wrote Case for Reparations, it was not my expectation. Nor did I even think it would be politically intelligent, like Barack Obama, to go up and yell, I'm for reparations. You know what I mean? But that's different than, you know what I mean, my role.
I guess the substructure of a bunch of what I am saying, which may or may not be an argument with you. It's just, right. When I texted you to come, I was like, I've been thinking about what the underlying arguments are here. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting this spilling out of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a work of politics that for a bunch of different reasons has become demeaned. And I think, and this does not speak well of the people, so to speak, in power doing it, but I think that they are not doing it well. I think the culture around them, I think politicians are not always leaders. I think they're often followers. And I think that the idea that that kind of political coalition building across these gigantic differences, building across public opinion, both not just as you wish it existed, but as it exists, has become, you know, seen and like treated as often betrayal, cowardice, moral fallibility. It's not, I think it's fine to say people got different roles. And in fact, it's good for intellectuals to criticize the politicians. But my view is that the political practice became too weak. I don't think that was true for Obama. I went back preparing to talk to you and I read your piece, My President Was Black.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
And it's very much in this tension, mm-hmm. right? Where you say quite a bit, like, it would have been a bad idea for Barack Obama to say the things I am saying here.
Yeah.
To do the things in some ways I wish he had done. It would have been, that politics wouldn't have worked. There would have been no Obama presidency and his presidency would not have been successful. And I think I've been thinking about that line, right? In my own work and just in the political culture as I see it, that line between the sort of intellectual analytical work and the actual like work of politics, the how do we live here with each other work, right? Which I think is actually honorable work. And I think feels right now to me like morally urgent and necessary. And not just over disagreement, just the whole thing being done in a strategic and disciplined sense. I think one of the things I've thought about is the need to actually raise the status of just like old-fashioned politics. And I think I've been surprised to find myself feeling that way. But I think one way the second Trump term has changed me is I don't, and maybe you always believe this, right? You know, I'm not putting this on you. I think what got built for all of its flaws in the back half of the 20th century was much more fragile than I'd understood. Not just like the legislation or any of that.
Mm.
But the actual sense of like what you could and could not do, what we would and would not accept. And I've just like the sense that we could just tumble all the way back has become much more real to me. And so the work that people did to begin to build those guardrails and like how hard that actually was, you know, and the disappointment we eventually, I feel like we began to take something actually quite beautiful for granted or only see what wasn't there as opposed to what was. And it's forced a little bit of, for me, like how did they do it? How did they get out of the last one of these?
You know, I'll just say, and I think I'm speaking for a broader community here. We are not happy, but we are not surprised, man. And again, the reason why we go back to Reconstruction and the Civil War is because it is, before the 1960s, the only glimpse at the possibility of a real democracy in this country. And it happened. And in some places, it was actually quite, quite successful. You know, you have people who, you know, had been enslaved, who were written off as illiterate fools, who, you know what I mean, serving in legislatures. And actually, you know, with the standard of the time, actually, it's such a hopeful, incredible, incredible story. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it was violently destroyed. You know, once you see that, and once you have that in your heritage, once you, you know what I mean, understand it, once you understand that Martin Luther King could be standing up telling his own people, we do not embrace violence at all. It is morally repugnant. We embrace love. And that could get you shot. Not burn it down. Love can get you shot. You know, you just have a different view of your country. You know, it is not, I emphasize this over and over again, it is not a fatalistic view. It is not, we, you know, it is written in stone that we will ultimately lose, but you understand that losing is a possibility.
But so then what does that, there's a Buddhist meditation I like.
Mm.
This is a weird place to go. But it goes like this. I'm of the nature to grow sick. I'm of the nature to grow old. Mm-hmm. I'm of the nature to lose the people I love. I'm of the nature to die. How then shall I live? And
I love that.
Yeah, I do it because sometimes you need the reminder.
Yeah.
What I hear you saying in a way is we are of the nature to.
Yeah.
And I think the place I'm trying to push is then, how then shall we live? Because in this distinction you're making between like, you would have been there correctly, yelling at FDR. And I'm not like asking you, but like me, right? Like my work, my role.
Can you answer that? Can you say what you, I think it's a good point. Would you define for me how you see like what your role is?
I don't know what my role is anymore. I'll be totally honest with you, man. I feel very conflicted about that question. The role I want to have is a person curiously exploring his political and intellectual interests in political peacetime. And the role I somehow have is sometimes that. But I am in the business. I'm a political opinion writer and podcaster and so on. And I'm in the business of political persuasion. And I feel like me and the people who believe what I believe, not narrowly speaking, but, you know, like the whole broad coalition, have failed in a really consequential way. And I think it is...
You feel like you failed in your work?
I think there are places I failed. I mean, I think there are things I got right too. Like, I think we shouldn't have run Joe Biden again. I think I was right about that. I think I've gotten a lot right, but I think I've gotten definitely things wrong. But I think we are here now, right? That's what I would really say. And it is forcing me to rethink things I would prefer not to rethink. I will give you an example because people are mad at me on this one right now.
Please.
I said in a podcast with my colleague, Russ Douthat, he was pushing me on left radicalism. I was like, I don't care about...
With who?
I said in a podcast with my colleague, Russ Douthat, he was pushing me on left radicalism. I was like, I don't care about loving radicalism. I don't think it's some great threat. I don't think it's a huge political problem. I worry about left-wing pessimism, fatalism, that we are losing and don't want to change anything. And I said that the question for me is, you know, how do we win Senate seats in places like Kansas and Missouri and Ohio? I said, I would like to see us doing things like in red states, and here I meant redder than those, you know, running pro-life candidates. People got real upset about that, and I get why. But in 2010, when the Affordable Care Act passed, there were 40 House Democrats who were pro-life at some level. You had to do this whole negotiation with this guy, Bart Stupak.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. And on the bright side, you don't have to have those negotiations now. And on the downside, you can't pass the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And the point is not that issue, right? That one issue, you know, although things like, you know, the example, say, Susan Collins, where she's in theory pro-choice, but she votes for Mitch McConnell right. and John Thune as leader. Right. Like, that's how you build power on some level, right? If you have those, you know, Joe Manchin, like, I wish he were still a senator from West Virginia, as much as I have deep disagreements with him. I think that I am a person, I think you are a person, whether you admit it or not, who is one of the people with a, you know, voice in shaping what our political culture is. Mm. And I believe at some level that political strategy is downstream from political culture. I think it means exploring things that are uncomfortable and being pretty disciplined in a way maybe I haven't been about separating the question of what I believe from what I believe will win power. Because I currently think that the cost of losing power is horrifying and dangerous.
Missouri governor signs new congressional map into law, erasing a Democratic seat. Wow.
And we can't keep doing it. So that's
yeah.
Where
so
my
can we stay
yeah.
with that exactly? You know, the immediate thing, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the immediate thing that springs to mind for me in that question is not who you're abandoning, but how do you square the fact that in fact reproductive rights has proven to be pretty popular in red states? And I'm thinking about referendums that have been passed, such that they've had to, you know, change the rules. Like, how do you separate that?
I sort of said this in
like the people who didn't vote for Kamala, but give me reproductive rights.
I think that I was using first. Pro-life is an illustrative example. Okay. But there are many red districts in this country. And there are states that we do not even think about competing in anymore. Right? I'm not talking about Ohio here. I think you have to try things. By the way, not only moderation kind of things. You could try going much harder on economic populism, which some people are trying. I think you might need to combine those two strategies. Yeah. Right? Which is sort of the Dan Osborne in Nebraska approach. I think that you... I think even before the question of what your policies are, and I believe this very deeply, there's a question of whether or not people feel like you respect them and like them, even if they disagree with you. Mm-hmm. Before, I think people will give you power. They don't even ask, do they like you? They ask whether you like them. And I think a lot of the country feels we don't like them. Mm. I know that. I've seen the focus groups. I've seen the survey data. I've talked to the people who work on this.
Why though?
And that's going to require...
Why though?
Changing that is going to require...
Because if they think that you don't like them, is it because of what you say? Or is it because of what the other side says you say? Right? Like if you were to ask the average conservative right now, what was the left's response to Charlie Kirk's shooting? The right is going to tell you what the right-leaning media has shown them of the left. Right? That's it. Nobody's going to show you Obama's statements, Biden's statements, Kamala's statements, all of the Democratic leadership, Congress people, like all of them. Like nobody's going to... So like you can't fight against that impression. The impression isn't even coming from you. It's coming from what the right is showing of you.
Making moves that somehow send a loud enough signal that people begin to think we've changed at some level. Sherrod Brown should be able to win in Ohio.
Yes.
The reason he cannot win in Ohio is the Democratic Party itself is a millstone around his neck that drags him down. Mm. So what do you do? I'm not here to tell you I got the answer.
Yeah.
What I feel much better about is I feel there was like a strategic discipline about finding it.
So I just
and what do you do? That's what he is exploring. I don't think he is exploring it. I think what he's trying to explore is like, how can we behave differently on like the, like we need to show the other, like not we need to show, but if we act in a different way than the other people will perceive it, we need to be fighting on the perception level a lot more. I think in like the media environment, like this has to be less of a, you know, touchy-feely conversation and more of like a very brutal media reality conversation. Like there needs to be like strategic conversations happening, not if we were just all nicer.
I feel much better about it. So I feel there was like a strategic discipline about finding it.
So I just if you will take this very gentle pushback.
Yeah, please.
I think
you're here for it.
I haven't seen exactly what people are saying, you know, online in terms of this, but I do think like what immediately strikes me is if you take, I know you would just, you know, it's not, you know, the example necessarily that you would hold out, you know, about reproductive rights, but I think the problem with musing about that is abandoning it is a very real possibility for people who don't have option necessarily fly to another state or do X, Y, and Z. So I suspect when they hear somebody of your status, even if it's not the example you mean, putting it out in the air, like they feel, and not, it's not just that you're putting it out in the air, it's putting it out in the air, and actually, I don't necessarily even mean that one.
No,
like, if you're going to say that, I think you really got to
stand behind
it. You got to put the data behind it. I think that's really, really important.
I will say, and I think this is actually the nub of it, right? Like, I'm glad we're sort of here. I am saying the thing it sounds like I'm saying. Mm-hmm. To be very, very clear,
right.
I think in a place like Nebraska, you should try to run some pro-life Democrats. I wish people, instead of saying that an expressive or strategic question in politics was betraying or abandoning mm-hmm. the people we wish to protect, I wish what we said was we lost power in a way that allowed Donald Trump to drive the Supreme Court to a 6-3 Republican majority. And that majority overturned Roe v. Wade.
Right.
It overturned Roe v. Wade and actually abandoned all these people.
Right.
Actually put them over. Right?
Right.
It is part of, I think, when I say that like the work of politics has become diminished, it is part of how that happened, that talking about this creates this sort of counter argument. Well, even to discuss it is to abandon. In 08, as you and I both know, Barack Obama ran as a public opponent of gay marriage.
Right.
He ran opposed to it.
Right.
At a time when not only, I won't speak for you, was I not opposed to it, no. but most of us did not. Yeah. Most of us did not.
I would have to go back and look at the polling for the time. Would I say that did Barack Obama run on an opposition to gay marriage? I know it was a thing that came up, and I know that he was opposed, at least softly, to gay marriage, but was that like the big election issue? I still feel like at the time, the big election issue had to do, I feel like the Middle East was a huge talking point still. I wonder if anybody has 2008 polling data. Like, what were the most important issues in 2008? I feel like the foreign stuff was still dominating. Like, I feel like he ran on, like, closing Guantanamo Bay and stuff, you know?
I think he was opposed to it.
Right.
Like, at his heart, we did not think he was opposed to it.
Right.
But he was playing politics.
Right.
That playing of politics allowed him to name Supreme Court justices, and that led to the decision that created a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And I am saying that that kind of playing politics is needed.
Oh, the recession stuff was a big one as well, yeah.
I can give you an example from the other
side. That's true,
Yeah, go for it.
Brother, you know what my position was.
Issues and the 2008 election. Economy top. Okay, so we have the economy is a huge one, 2008. Energy is a huge. Oh, I feel like I've looked at this one before. Energy is a huge one. Oh, gay marriage is at 28%. Yeah, no, this was not that important of an issue, I think. Iraq was at 72%. Healthcare and education were up there. Terrorism in Iraq, yeah, kind of go hand in hand, I think. And economy and energy were the big boys here, but.
During the election about Palestine, about Gaza, Kamala Harris was running to be the first black woman to be president of the United States. You cannot imagine how animated black folks were. And some of the base of the Democratic Party, black women, you know, we're going to, you know, see this thing. She was not taking a position that I thought was particularly moral. I had to talk in front of black audiences about that. You know what I mean? And I had to do the other thing, which was go before African American audiences here, Palestinian American audiences here, and say, look, I'm with you. You can be mad at me. You probably will be mad at me. I get it. But for me, politics is the, you know, the lesser of two evils. We've been fighting this battle for a long time. We've never had the luxury of electing people that represented the best of us. And this is why I'm voting for her. This is a really, really.
Ezra isn't saying gay marriage was an important issue. He was saying we can allow some Democrats to adopt policies that don't spoil their voter base, regardless of importance. Yeah, but I don't like comparing gay marriage in 2008 to abortion in 2025. I think abortion is a way more topical and important issue right now than gay marriage was in 2008. Like, we just had Roe v. Wade obliterated, and conservatives have basically made abortion illegal. What, a third of the states in the U.S. right now? How many states in the United States right now have abortion as being basically illegal at 6 weeks and beyond? Like, that's insane. That's insane.
Serious thing. And when you hear these Palestinian Americans, and when you hear these Muslim Americans, and when you hear these Arab Americans upset about this, you know, you can't just yell at them. You have to take them seriously. These were hard, very, very difficult conversations. But they were, when I made those conversations, look, man, I had to be buttoned up about it. I just think you take very, very seriously the need to convince people outside of the tent right now, right? About, yeah. Like we have to convince them to come in. I guess what I want from you is I want you to take as seriously people who are in the tent and who are vulnerable and afraid. And if you have to convince them of something that's extremely, extremely uncomfortable, or tell them that you're taking a position that is extremely I just think you owe them a little more. That's
yeah,
all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll take it. But I want to put this on you for a minute, right? Sure. You keep sort of putting it back on me.
Yeah, I'm open. Go ahead. I'm
you keep putting it back on me here on the Ta-Nehisi Coates Show. What then should we do? What then should be? You are one of the most influential public intellectuals in the country. I know you don't like to think of politics as a thing you do, but it is a thing you do. What, as bad as you know this can get, and given that you're not a hopeless person or who, you know, doesn't think you should just collapse into fatalism, what do you think should happen now?
I think that really depends on what your role is. I don't have a great overarching theory for what everybody needs to do because I think we all have different positions. You know, I know what my role is. And I do see myself as part of politics, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a very, very important way of answering the question. I mean, I'm not going to be the person that yells at you because, you know, you went on a bunch of right-wing podcasts. I, you know, as I've said many times, you know, in the course of this interview, I see myself as a writer. I see myself as a journalist. I see myself as someone for whom it's very, very important to state the truth plainly and to clarify things as best I can. I'm not a strategist for the party, you know, and I've tried, as you raised in that Barack Obama piece, I've tried to respect the difference.
I guess I'm not pushing you to be a political strategist, right? I think that for me, something you see me doing right here, mm-hmm. something I think people reacted to me doing, is saying, well, the fight is this profound and we're losing the fight. Then the question is to think about how we fight.
Right.
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 It's something about knowing that this much of the country is, on the wrong side of what my line would have been.
Right.
Knowing that what Kirk was doing, what people like him were doing was working.
Right.
That imposes a set of questions upon us that need to be answered.
Right. The thing I'm struggling with in this conversation and even in that question is the fact that there are things that you yourself have actually advocated for that had they been done, we would be having a very different conversation.
I think I want it to not be close.
You said what?
I want it to not be
close.
Oh,
you want, I'll see. I mean, you will call this my fatalism, but I am not surprised. I think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be close for a very, very long time. I would like for it to be less close too. But
do you think that's within our power? Not really.
Listen, I have a friend, and I'm not going to out him. He's a mutual friend of ours who always says, this is the best set of white folks we have ever had in the entire history of Black America. This is the most woke. This is the least racist. This is the most aware group that we have had. You know what I mean? Like for us, and for those of us who ground ourselves in a larger tradition, this is not close. Like this is a, you know, remarkable, remarkable time, you know, in terms of our freedom, you know, as writers and journalists to speak to people in terms of the amount of people who are empowered and have some amount of privilege and could just look away and are not looking away. You know, it's not a great time politically. You understand what I'm saying? But it's just, it's not the worst either.
No, it's not.
It's not the worst, you know?
All right, then I think always our final question. What are three books you recommend to the audience?
So, the first book is a book called The Brothers by Stephen Kinzer, which is a joint biography of Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles, and how incredibly one was head of the State Department, the other was head of the CIA, and how they worked to overthrow multiple countries during Eisenhower's time. It's just an incredible, mind-boggling book, and it's helping me answer some questions about the role of America in the broader world. The second one is An Oldie But Goodie, which I reached for before I wrote my piece, is Race and Reunion by David Blight, which I think is just essential because it shows how a country forgets and forgets in service of a politic that I would say is problematic. The third one is our mutual friend Chris Hayes' book, Siren's Call, which I think, in fact, actually tells us a lot about the conversation that we're having today, you know, and the influence of social media screens and distraction.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, man. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hey, everybody.
34 minutes.